I think it's safe to say that when people generally talk about reading the Bible or wanting to turn to the pages of our scriptures, that they do so with the expectation that doing that action will result in something inspiring, something encouraging, something that would make you feel good and encourage you to keep moving on in your life. That generally is the case. In fact, much devotional literature is written specifically with that in mind. What can we draw from the Bible that encourages? But any of you who've actually picked up the book and read it will discover that, of course, there are many, many passages that don't seem to do that job very well. That rather than providing something encouraging for us, they provide for us something challenging, something perhaps even a little bit disturbing, something mystifying, something where we're wondering, is that really in the Bible? Well, this morning, we've heard some of that again. We're doing this series of preaching through the seven little letters to the seven churches in Asia Minor in the book of Revelation, chapter 2 and chapter 3. And 2 weeks ago when we started this series, I had mentioned that the Revised Common Lectionary never touches Revelation chapter 2 and chapter 3. And I think this might be one of the reasons, because the words contained in these little letters are rather pointed and difficult and challenging. All the more reason for us to take a good look at them, to hear what the Spirit is actually saying to the churches. And so this morning you heard Donna read the letters to Smyrna and to Sardis. This, by the way, is the last Sunday where we have to try to do two of these little letters at once, because we have 3 Sundays left in Easter and 3 more churches to go, so that'll simplify things in the weeks to come, I promise you. But here we have the church in Smyrna, which was a significant city on the west coast of Asia Minor, what is now modern-day Turkey. It was not only a port city and so was doing well that way, it was also another city like Pergamum that we talked about last week that was a significant hub of the imperial cult. That the worship of the Roman emperor, the Caesar, being acknowledged as Lord, this was a key feature for Smyrna. In this case, it was Caesar Tiberius. That was the one who was most recognized and honored and worshipped there. 60 kilometers to the east, inland, is Sardis. And this is another significant city, but it's significant in a different way. It was a very economically sound city. They had a strong textile industry, producing wools and other fabrics and stuff. And so it was a very wealthy city for that reason. And what we find, of course, is that the church was established in both of these cities. But the experiences of the two churches couldn't have been more different. How the Christians were making a go of life in Smyrna is quite a bit different from how they were making a go of life in Sardis. And so let's turn our attention to Smyrna to begin. Jesus writes to Smyrna, to the angel of the church in Smyrna, write these words. And what we need to understand right away is that there is this pattern I said about how these letters work. And 2 parts of the pattern was we would generally see Jesus say something good about what he sees in the church. You guys are doing this well. And then he would say, but this I hold against you. This is something you have to address. You got to fix this. In the letter to Smyrna, Jesus has nothing good to say. Nothing bad to say to the church. He has nothing negative to say about the church in Smyrna at all. Instead, he acknowledges that the circumstances they found themselves in were rather dramatic. And so when we get into the letter to Smyrna, he says this, I know your affliction and your poverty, even though you are rich. What Jesus acknowledges for the church in Smyrna is that they were going through a very difficult time. The affliction they were experiencing was persecution. It was even state-sponsored persecution. And as a result, they found themselves in economic hardship. They were poor. They were a church that was not doing well, having a tough time making ends meet. And the reason why the persecution would have come upon them is precisely because it was a city that was all about that imperial cult. And so everybody is expected to say, Caesar is Lord, except the Christians aren't saying that. They're saying Jesus is Lord instead. And as a result, they were having conflict with the authorities. Then on top of that, the economic challenge probably came from 2 different sources. One of them would have been, well, much like happened to the Jews in Nazi Germany. Because the government was opposing them, their businesses were being shuttered, they were being robbed, they were being incarcerated, and basically having a great difficulty trying to make ends meet because of that kind of persecution. But what is also likely is that they weren't able to get access to many occupations simply because they were being discriminated against for being Christians in the first place, but also because many occupations in that city would have required them to make that Caesar is Lord proclamation. And they're saying, as a Christian, as one endeavoring to be faithful to Jesus, I can't do that. Jesus is Lord, not Caesar. And so the church was encountering challenges both from without and as a result of their faithfulness to God. But this is exactly why Jesus said, even though I know your affliction and poverty, you are rich. You are rich spiritually. You are rich because you are holding fast. And then he goes on to say something else that is also troubling. He says, I know the slander from those who call themselves Jews but are not, but instead are a synagogue of Satan. We read those words, and now it sounds like the Bible's being anti-Semitic. Well, make no mistake. People have used that verse in the past to carry on an anti-Semitic perspective. That's right. The Jews, they're the synagogue of Satan. And no doubt that verse was used to help justify the actions of Nazi Germany back before World War II against the Jews. But that is not what's being driven at here. Jesus is the one saying these words. Jesus himself was Jewish. Everything about the Christian faith comes out of Judaism. He cannot simply be making this blanket statement about Jews in general. And I would say to you, that is exactly not what is happening here. Instead, what he's saying is this. Anybody who is Jewish is to be ones who follow the Torah. They are to love the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love their neighbors as themselves. And this is a key theme in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament, over and over and over again. Even though a person would be Jewish because they were born into a Jewish family, the message in the Old Testament repeatedly is, it's not enough to simply be a Jew outwardly, you must be a Jew inwardly. You must be living out the commands of God and the Torah of God. And so there's something about what these Jews are doing that is causing them to receive this criticism from Christ. And what it was, I know the slander of those who say they are Jews. What's the ninth commandment? Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. And the Jews in Smyrna were doing exactly that. They were violating the Torah. They were violating the Ten Commandments by slandering other Christians. Now, the government had a program in which citizens could report on other citizens who were not being loyal to the Caesar, not being loyal to the emperor. They could be finked on, right? And that was happening to many of the Christians in there. But what was happening with these certain Jews, they were going a step further and actually slandering them, violating the Torah. Jesus's criticism of these particular Jews is not a criticism of Jews in general, but what was happening by particular ones who truly had an agenda against the Christians. And so in saying all of this, what we discover is the Christians in Smyrna are experiencing tremendous challenges. And when we read that Jesus is saying, I see what's going on, I recognize the difficulty you're in, I think we would expect that Jesus would then say, and I want you to know that I'm going to take care of all of these problems for you. I want you to know that I see the difficulty, don't worry, it's all going to come to an end. But that's not what Jesus says. What he says next is this, do not fear what you are about to suffer. Beware, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison so that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have affliction. Be faithful unto death. These are not at first blush very comforting words. Jesus is saying, yeah, life's difficult, I see that. It's going to get worse. And we might read those words and think, how on earth are the Christians in Smyrna supposed to take any kind of comfort to think that the God that loves them, the good shepherd of the sheep, is somehow still on their side if he's not going to do anything about what they're experiencing? But we must remember that part of the reason why the Bible has challenging texts like this in it is because life is challenging. Life is difficult. If the Bible did not contain challenging passages that really speak to the reality of life, then all we would have is a fluffy book of platitudes that doesn't do much good for us at all. Because the reality is difficulties happen. And that's acknowledged even as early as 1,000 years earlier than this was written. 3,000 years ago, when King David wrote Psalm 23, the wonderful shepherd psalm, a key verse in that psalm is this: "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." Why? "Because you are with me." Even in King David's day, it was clear that we are not always exempted from walking through the valley of the shadow of death. Though we might like it to be so, we are not always given the wings of an eagle and can soar high above all of our troubles, and Jesus just exempts us from them. The reality is, all human beings walk through the valley of the shadow of death for a variety of reasons, and Christians are no exception. We do not get a get-out-of-jail-free card automatically just because we worship Jesus. And even though the Christians in Smyrna were experiencing this difficulty precisely because they were Christians, the point remains, Jesus says, "I see what you're doing. I am there with you. I get it. I know exactly what's going on, and you are doing well. I need to let you know it is going to get worse. But be faithful, even faithful unto death." And he promises, "I will give you the crown of life." To anyone who overcomes this difficulty and challenge that's coming, you need not fear the second death. And what Jesus is saying about that is for them to remember that part of the blessed Christian hope is that there is more to life than just this one. That it isn't just about what we experience here. Not that there's any attempt to minimize the reality of the challenges in this life, but there is a hope of that life eternal that is yet to come. And Jesus holds this up before them. When you think about it, the experience of the church in Smyrna 2,000 years ago mirrors very closely the experience of the church in many places in the world, many third world nations, many other nations where they are very hostile towards Christianity. There are many people in the world today, many Christians, who would identify 100% with what the Smyrnan Christians were experiencing. And they would take comfort in knowing that Jesus sees what's going on. And indeed, the knowledge that the Lord is with them is what sustains them. And so even though we want Jesus to say something else to Smyrna, he doesn't. But he affirms them of his presence and of the reward yet to come, and that there is so much more to life than just this one. As we turn our attention to Sardis, everything's different now. Whereas the church in Smyrna, Jesus had nothing bad to say about it, in Sardis, Jesus has nothing good to say about the church in Sardis. Instead, he starts right away by saying, "You have a name of being alive, but you are dead." We don't like to hear those words either. We don't want to hear Jesus saying to his people, "There's a problem with what you're doing." We don't like the idea that the Prince of Peace, the one who loves us so much, would say to us, "You know what, there's a serious problem going on here." But how could it be otherwise? If we bear the name of Christ, it only makes sense that Jesus would be the one saying, "Are you reflecting my character in bearing my name? Are you being the followers of Christ that you say that you are?" And what he has to say to Sardis in this case is they weren't doing that. And so he gives them very clear instructions. He says, "Wake up and strengthen what remains and is on the point of death, for I have not found your works perfect in the sight of my God." Perfect in this case means complete. "I have not found your works complete." In other words, you're leaving things out. There are things you're not doing. "So remember then what you received and heard. Obey it and repent." Those are very directed commands from Christ. The church in Sardis had grown complacent. It had been enjoying the successes of the textile industry they were participating in. There was no persecution. They're kind of living on easy street. There was no challenge to anything. They could live in peace. It was fine. It was wonderful. Pretty much like living in a first world nation like Canada. And so they had just grown accustomed to having the name tag that said that they were a Christian. And it seems that their perspective was, "Yeah, you know, I was baptized as an infant, right? So, you know, my ticket's been punched, I'm good." And that's as far as it went. And Jesus is saying, "You're leaving out so much." You see, here's the thing. we recognize that we are to, as the Jews were told, we too share that same command, that we are to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbors as ourselves. But that means there has to be action to demonstrate that. It's not enough just to say it. There needs to be an activity that goes along with that statement that we say we are holding to. So, for example, when it comes to loving our neighbors as ourselves, if we're supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves, how would our neighbor know that we love him? Would it be because we just said, "Hey, I love you, Chip"? Or is it because it's demonstrated? Is there evidence that we actually love him in our conduct, in our conversation? Could he tell that we love our neighbors? The proof would not be there if there wasn't something demonstrated, if actions, if works were not going along with the faith that we proclaim. In the letter to James, James says, "Faith without works is dead." There needs to be that evidence. Furthermore, our love for God, how is that demonstrated? Is it just because we say we love God? But our love for God means there's going to be activity that shows that. That we are listening and paying attention to what the Spirit says to the church. That we are indeed showing our love for God. And I'm not talking about some kind of crazy exuberance or something. I'm not saying we got to go preach on the streets. That's not what I'm saying. But our love for God would need to be demonstrated by more than just, you know, showing up on Sunday. The church in Sardis was just phoning it in. They're just showing up on Sunday. They got the Christian name tag, but there was no evidence, really, that they were people of faith. Many years ago, someone suggested this scenario. If you were hauled into court, someone was accusing you of being a Christian, and you're going into court to make that point, would there be enough evidence to convict you? It's a really good question. Because being a follower of Jesus is demonstrable. It is shown somehow. The church in Sardis would not have been convicted because there's no evidence that they were actually followers of Jesus. The message we receive is that we need to be paying attention and living out our faith and walking in Jesus' footsteps. That's what we have to hold on to, especially being in a first world nation where there's freedom of religion. We don't ever have to be afraid to come to church. It's easy to go to church. It's just as easy not to go to church. But we have to hold on to the fact that there is danger of complacency when there's no challenge to our faith. And so it's not wrong for Christians to live in Sardis. It's not bad that the Christians in Sardis were sharing in the wealth of the city. It's not a problem that they were living where there was no persecution. There's nothing wrong with any of those things. But unfortunately, they became complacent. And so Jesus has a few more words to say to them. He acknowledges, first of all, that not everybody in the church in Sardis was like this. He said there are a few people who have not soiled their clothes. They have been kept keeping faithful and so on. But then he goes on and he says this: "If you overcome this complacency, you will be clothed in white robes, and I will not blot your name out of the book of life." Why did he have to go and say that? Especially since 2 weeks ago I said we don't have to be afraid of being held to account by Jesus, because God is a good father, a good heavenly parent. He's not going to be in a hurry to kick us out of the family if we don't do right. And then Jesus says, "If you overcome, I won't blot your name out of the book of life." To put it very plainly, the book of life shows up at the end of Revelation, and the metaphor is this, that there's this big book with names in it. If your name is in the book, you get to go to heaven. If your name isn't in the book, you get to go to hell. If your name was in the book and Jesus erased your name from the book, you don't get to go to heaven, you get to go to hell instead. That's what Jesus is basically saying right here. So what are we supposed to do with that? Well, let me throw this out. There's no question that there are many tensions in the scriptures, paradoxes and stuff. Let me simply walk you through this perspective. You can go into the Bible and you can find a whole pile of verses that say, yeah, you better watch out, you might lose your salvation. You can also go through the Bible and find a whole pile of verses that say, nope, no possibility, that can never happen. You've been engraved on the palm of God's hand. He can never let you go. Even our gospel was suggesting that, as Jesus said, "My sheep hear my voice, I know them, and they follow me. I give them eternal life, and they will never perish. No one will snatch them out of my hand." Of course, someone could say, "Well, yeah, but Jesus still might let you go." The debate is there. Let me simply say this. If everything that we do as Christians is geared around how we answer that question, there are two significant dangers to focusing on that. If on the one hand we become convinced or we're concerned that we might possibly lose our salvation and so we got to make sure we live rightly so that Jesus doesn't blot our name out of the book of life, then what can happen is we can find ourselves now paralyzed by anxiety and despair. And we can wonder, oh, you know, am I still on the right track? Or, oh my goodness, I got to repent right now because I think I might have lost my salvation. And did I commit the unforgivable sin? I've had conversations with people who have been anxious like that. And if you're anxious like that because you're concerned, oh my goodness, I might get my name blotted out, then you're going to be paralyzed to inaction. We have to avoid that possibility. If, on the other hand, you're on the other side and convinced, oh yeah, that's right. I mean, once you're in, it's good to go. I mean, yeah, I probably should, you know, be a better Christian, you know, but it's all right because I'm in, right? No one can snatch me out of Jesus' hand. And that can lead to a concern of complacency. Let us not let the issue be whether or not you might ever lose your salvation or if your name gets erased. Let's instead be the focus be on what it is that Jesus says we are to do. That we are to not be complacent, but demonstrate our faith in our words and our deeds. In both situations, the third world persecution of Smyrna and the first world affluence of Sardis, Jesus' message to both churches is essentially the same. Be faithful. Have a life that is full of faith in me, in God. Be a life that demonstrates that faith in what you are doing, both in persevering despite horrible persecution that might be come your way, but also by resisting the temptation to be complacent because life is easy. In both cases, faithfulness is the solution. And so our desire then at the Church of the Good Shepherd is to learn from these two letters, as uncomfortable as they are, and recognize that our goal and our desire is to demonstrate our faith, that we could be convicted for being Christians if anyone ever wanted to find proof of it, and that it would not be difficult. So everyone who has ears to hear, let them listen to what Jesus says to the church. Amen.